You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
The president has shown he's unafraid to use military options if and when he deems necessary, and nobody knows that better than Iran.
They better behave.
The Iranians are prepared to die for this cause, and so am I.
This murder, the invasion of Venezuela, and the threats to invade other countries must be our red line. This must be our red line.
To ICE, get the f*** out of Minneapolis.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett in Sydney, reunited with international correspondent Claudia Farhat in Jakarta. No such thing as a quiet January in news, Claudia.
No, not one that I've seen yet, at least, Kat. Welcome back, and I guess welcome to another wild week. We're going to be looking at the massive political repercussions after that fatal shooting of a woman in Minneapolis by a US immigration officer this week.
Plus, US President Donald Trump's push for Venezuela's oil hits the skids as he struggles to convince oil execs to open their wallets.
And is Iran's decades-long regime on the brink of collapsing? We're going to be speaking with our Persian language reporter, Niv Sajalotabai, who has been closely following the developments on the ground.
And by the way, to all Iranian patriots, keep protesting, take over your institutions if possible. And I've canceled all meetings with the Iranian officials until the senseless killing of protesters stops. And all I say to them is help is on its way.
So what began with a group of shopkeepers protesting in the bazaars of Tehran has now turned into arguably Iran's single largest episode of civil unrest since the birth of the Islamic Republic. It's now been almost 3 weeks since it all began, and the protests are only getting bigger. They've spread to all 31 of Iran's provinces. But as the movement grows, so do the regime's efforts to quash it, Claudia. Witnesses are now describing a crackdown that is nothing short of brutal. The US-based human rights activists' news agency says more than 500 protesters have been killed, and that does include children. And more than 10,000 people have been arrested already. But given the Iranian authorities have now largely cut off access to the internet and phone lines, we really don't know how accurate those numbers are. It's entirely possible the real figures could be far greater. Senior Iranian officials speaking to the media anonymously are now saying the death toll could actually be around 3,000. But still, the public isn't backing down, Claudia.
Yeah, Kat. I mean, Iranians are no strangers to these kinds of large-scale protests. It's how the last Shah was overthrown and how the Islamic Republic was born. And we've seen flare-ups of unrest every few years, pretty much ever since. But Iranians are pretty consistently saying that this time feels different. This time it's not about political freedoms or about women's rights, as important as those things are. This is now about their actual survival. The economic crisis has gotten so bad that some estimates are putting half the population below the poverty line now. So we're talking about people who were comfortably middle class a year ago, now struggling just to put food on their tables. And it's also coming after the US and Israel strikes on Iran last year. For years and years and years, the regime told the public that it was pouring all of the money it did into its so-called axis of resistance, into its nuclear program, to keep them safe, to act as the ultimate deterrent, right? And in the end, it meant nothing. Not only did the US hit what was long thought to be the unhittable, its nuclear program, they also killed some of their most senior military commanders. It was just humiliating for Iran. And it's hard to see how that wouldn't now be playing into this sort of total lack of trust in the regime. If it can't protect itself, how can it protect the public? Pouring fuel on the fire has been the US President Donald Trump. He's now saying help is on its way to these Iranian protesters, but there's been no indication of what that help might look like. And apparently he's not too keen on regime change anyway, for the fear of, you know, the bloody fallout that would all but certainly follow. This week, he announced an extra 25% tariff on any country doing business with Tehran, effective immediately. So he may be hoping that sanctions will do the job for him, or at least force the Ayatollah to the table, because, I mean, that's how we got here in the first place. It was the sanctions that has exacerbated this economic crisis to the point where people just had to get in the streets.
The Iranian government is now trying to downplay the whole thing, essentially. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has dismissed the movement as a, quote, foreign plot being led by Iran's enemies. We also saw the foreign minister come out on Monday and declare the entire situation was now under control. But even with an information blackout, it's clear that that's not the case. The son of the last Shah, Reza Pahlavi, is hoping to capitalise on these protests. Many of the protesters are now actually calling for him to come back, although it's unclear how much actual support he has or whether he is more a name of convenience and a name people are familiar with. His father's regime wasn't exactly universally loved, and as you said, Claudia, he was overthrown by the 1979 popular uprising that saw the current regime take power.
Exactly. And for that reason, he's a divisive figure. His father oversaw some pretty horrific human rights abuses as Shah. And more recently, Pahlavi himself has also copped criticism for attacking other dissidents in exile, but also for openly supporting Israel. But he's now been doing the rounds in the US, where he's been living in exile for almost 50 years now, spurring these protesters on, telling them to prepare for his return. He says he wants to lead the country to proper elections. So who knows? But I think what's been interesting about it is usually whenever we have this conversation and we talk about the prospect of the Iranian regime falling, it's almost immediately met with the counter question, well, who would step in to run the place if it did fall? And there's never really been a viable answer to that in the past other than the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which I guess many would argue would leave the Iranian people even worse off. And this time around, we have this figure that many people, not everybody, but many people, are throwing their support behind. So I think that is only lending weight to this idea that the regime might actually be done for this time. It's still a real stretch to see how it might come about, though, and if he would be the character, the figure to lead the country after that. Joining us now is our Persian language reporter, Niv Sadralodabayi, who's been spending the past few weeks speaking to protesters on the ground in Iran as this movement has grown and grown. Thanks so much for coming back on the pod, Niv.
Thanks for having me, Claudia.
Niv, we've been talking about this total internet blackout in Iran. How tough has it been for you and your team to get in touch with people on the ground this week?
Yeah, it's been almost impossible to touch base with people on the ground in the last weeks, especially since the blackout started in the last 5 days. A couple of people I knew had Starlink connections with internet and Starlink, but they even got disconnected in the last 2 days. Last night, some people from Iran could have made phone calls to outside, but that was the only way to make connections in the last 5 days since the blackout started. You cannot call inside, but they can call you directly from inside Iran. That's the only way to get in touch with Iran currently.
Yeah, when you have been able to get in touch with them, I mean, what are they describing to you? What are they telling you about this, you know, what sounds like an increasingly brutal government crackdown?
Yeah, apparently this time the protests in Iran is very different than the previous ones. Like, people are hearing shooting and sounds of explosions outside of their home in very local areas. So it's apparently very different, and people I'm talking with, they all know people who've been killed in the protests. So it kind of shows that the numbers are growing, the numbers of people who've been killed in the protests, and everyone is saying it's very different than the previous protests, especially the crackdown.
Yeah, we're getting so much conflicting information about the casualty toll on the ground. Some estimates are saying hundreds of people killed, others thousands, some even passing 10,000 now. What are you hearing from protesters about how security forces are reacting, and is it escalating?
Yeah, the numbers are going higher. So Harana, which is a human rights organization, Iranian, reported about 600 protesters being killed yesterday, but they increased the number to more than 2,000 just in one day today. So the numbers are increasing. Iran International, another Persian media, has reported of 12,000 protesters being killed. Pictures and videos showing are being shown in the social media shows that lots of people are being killed. There are pictures of dead bodies on the ground in different areas, very horrifying pictures. So it seems like numbers are much higher comparing to any other protest movement in Iran. But also there is lots of hope. Some people are very hopeful, more than previous protests, that things might change very quickly in Iran. So I can see that it's very different comparing to the previous movements.
Niv, you mentioned there's a lot of hope from protesters on the ground, but what are they actually calling for? Is it really possible to topple this decades-long regime?
Look, I think what we've seen in last year, especially even what happened with Syria, is giving people a lot of hope, because no one expected for the Assad regime to fall so quickly, and just happened in just days, even probably one night. So seeing all those things going around has made people hopeful that the situation might suddenly change. There are hope from people inside the regime to turn against the regime. Obviously, there are some other international pressure going on, and many people even are looking forward for that. So there are hope, but obviously there are different ideas about how things might change.
Niv, thank you so much for joining us on the pod this week, for telling us about some of your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
You want to come at us? I say go get yourself some lunch, big boy. Go ahead.
Out of the car. Get out of the car. Get out of the car.
That was one of several videos that's been circulating widely in the past week of the moment US immigration officer Jonathan Ross fatally shot 37-year-old Renee Good, who was driving in a residential neighborhood in the northern city of Minneapolis. It sparked outrage in the US and abroad. A week later, we are still seeing rallies across the country in protest of the fatal shooting. Good is the second person to be killed by ICE, which is the US Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, in these raids, as part of a broader immigration crackdown by federal agents in the country since Donald Trump returned to office almost a year ago now.
An investigation into the incident is already being called a sham by the state governor and the city's mayor, as Trump and his administration immediately came out publicly blaming Good as a, quote, domestic terrorist, and saying the officer was simply acting in self-defense, in spite of the video seemingly showing a very different narrative. State officials and locals say Good, a mother of three, was simply trying to flee the scene. It's worth noting that Good was present at the time as a legal observer, which is essentially a volunteer who monitors government officers at protests and operations and tries to deter misconduct.
And there's been a wave of resignations across the Justice Department following this. So four top department leaders have now gone, and six federal prosecutors in Minnesota also resigned in protest of a move to investigate Renee Good's widow, who was in the car at the time, sitting in the passenger seat. Trump's response has been absolutely defiant. He posted online saying a day of retribution and reckoning is coming. At the same time, hundreds more federal agents have been deployed to Minneapolis in what's been dubbed Operation Metro Surge.
Yeah, Trump's opponents say the whole immigration crackdown is politically motivated, particularly in terms of the predominantly blue states and cities that are being targeted in all of this. One of the theories for the Trump administration's often seemingly bold-faced lies, according to political experts, is to demonstrate they simply can't be held accountable, and also to distract and confuse the public. Knowing their own supporters generally watch the right-wing, pro-Trump media outlets that rarely contradict him.
Yeah, but if we've seen anything from these demonstrations is that there's still clearly a very strong opposition to ICE enforcement in the city and beyond. We've seen mostly peaceful mass protests continuing to unfold across the country, but Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has warned demonstrators not to resort to violence. He says that's exactly what the Trump administration will be wanting.
Yeah, absolutely. Who knows where this might end in terms of the clash of ideologies unfolding in the US. And there's still 9 months to go until the midterm elections, so plenty to look out for.
Do you see any checks on your power on the world stage? Is there anything that could stop you if you wanted to?
Yeah, there's one thing, my own morality, my own mind. It's the only thing that can stop.
And, not international law.
And that's very good. I don't need international law. I'm not looking to hurt people.
President Trump there answering the question whether there were any limits to his global powers. The capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has become a focus for concerns around US policy and its basis in international law. President Trump has been pretty full-throated in his view that he controls Venezuela now, and more specifically, its oil. Trump has said the US would run Venezuela for an unspecified amount of time. So what started as a drug operation with Maduro accused of narco-terrorism now looks a lot more like a colonial-style land grab. Having admitted he didn't consult Congress, he has consulted oil executives, pushing them to step in and provide the vast sums of cash needed to get the oil flowing again. But not all of them are keen, much to his frustration, Claudia.
Yeah, Kat, these big oil companies are approaching the situation with a lot of caution, especially ExxonMobil, which described Venezuela's oil industry as uninvestable during a White House meeting last week. And that led Donald Trump to threaten to block the company altogether from investing in Venezuelan oil, saying he didn't like Exxon's response. Trump is assuring these US oil companies that they would be dealing directly with the US government rather than anyone in Venezuela after his claims that the US will be taking over the sales of something like 30 to 50 million barrels of previously sanctioned Venezuelan oil. These oil execs are fully aware that Venezuela is teetering on economic collapse, but the president is doing everything in his power to convince them that there's enough stability and enough opportunity to make it worth their while. At the same time, he's warning them, well, if they don't go in, Russia and China could swoop at any moment.
One thing I think everyone has to know is that if we didn't do this, China or Russia would have done it. And if China or Russia were a next-door neighbor, because essentially this is not around the other parts of the world so far away where you fly an airplane for 24 hours before you get there. This is sort of a next-door neighbor, if you think about it. And I told China and I told Russia, we get along with you very well. We like you very much. We don't want you there. Not going to be there. And if we didn't do this, China would have been there and Russia would have been there. Maybe they both would have been there together, but they're not going to be there now.
Yeah, as you can hear, he's, you know, certainly using this thread of Russian or Chinese influence to try and justify his control over Venezuela and its oil supply. Before the US seized Maduro, the majority of Venezuelan oil was going to China, although some still to the US. Venezuela did have a prosperous oil industry in the late 90s and early 2000s, but when state control was reasserted over the industry and it was targeted by US sanctions, output dropped significantly. Trump is adamant now that control over Venezuelan oil resources will bring wealth to US citizens and partially Venezuelans. And now there's Trump's threats to Cuba thrown into the mix. The president has presented an ultimatum, essentially, to the island nation. He's demanding they strike a deal with the US and is cutting off Venezuelan oil unless they comply. Although actual details of what the deal will look like are so far unclear.
Yeah, so we're talking about this strict oil blockade that the US has imposed on Venezuela, and it's causing massive problems for Cuba because Venezuela is Cuba's single largest oil supplier. But Cuba isn't backing down, at least not yet, Kat. President Miguel Díaz-Canel has rejected Trump's threats on social media. He's saying Cuba's a free and sovereign nation and nobody can dictate to it. Regardless, it is another example of the Trump administration's attempts to sort of bring regional powers in line with the US. And Trump's confiscating these sanctioned Venezuelan oil tankers has already had huge repercussions for Cuba. It's worsening what was already a really bad energy crisis.
Yeah, and incredibly, it isn't just traditional US foes Trump is targeting in his backyard either. He's continued to up the pressure on Greenland, insisting the US has to have the vast icy island, otherwise China or Russia will get it. This despite the fact the self-governed Danish territory is a NATO ally. His latest claims that Russian and Chinese destroyers, as well as Russian subs, are, quote, all over the place, have been widely ridiculed. Now time for a quick look at some of the other big stories that have been making headlines this week. Displaced Syrians have begun returning to contested areas in Aleppo after a ceasefire between the Syrian military and the Kurdish-led Syrian Defence Forces brought to an end days of intense fighting. Under the agreement, SDF fighters have now evacuated from two pockets in the city that they had controlled since the outbreak of the country's civil war in 2011.
The clashes between the two sides, which are both backed by the US, left almost two dozen people dead and forced more than 140,000 to flee. It also exposed the difficulty that the country's new president, Ahmed al-Shara, faces as he attempts to unify Syria's many factions.
And Ukrainian forces have this week struck three Russian drilling platforms in the Caspian Sea as part of an effort to weaken Moscow's ability to fund its war. The platforms all belonged to Lukoil, one of Russia's largest oil producers, and are used to extract both oil and gas, which supplies the Russian army.
Yeah, Ukraine had been ramping up strikes on Russian oil production facilities and vessels in the Caspian Sea since late last year, a sign of Kyiv's willingness to strike at targets deep inside Russian territory. Moscow has also unleashed a surge of attacks on Ukraine's energy infrastructure this week that have left many Ukrainians without electricity in the freezing depths of winter.
And the Yemeni government says it has retaken full control of the country's south after a lightning advance by the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council last month. Backed by Saudi Arabia, government forces unleashed a heavy air campaign against the separatists after they announced plans to secede within 2 years.
And the STC's future is now totally in doubt. Late last week, members of a delegation the group sent to Riyadh for talks announced they would be disbanding altogether. That was almost immediately rejected by the group's spokesperson, who said that Central Command back in Yemen had lost contact with the delegation in Saudi Arabia. So we could now be looking at a split within the group.
The world is just a great big onion.
Well, if we've learned anything in the first 2 weeks of 2026, yep, it's only been 2 weeks of the new year, it's that the world is full of problems. Some of them are big, some of them are small, and some of them, where you are, Claudia, are root vegetables.
Some of them are indeed, Kat. Look, it's been a heavy week for everyone, I think. So I thought I'd share with you one of my favourite stories out of Indonesia with you.
Oh, go on, cheer us up. Appeal to the audience, if you must. Sorry, I had
to. Don't worry. It's about to get so much worse. Don't worry.
Oh.
Okay, so the government here has announced that it is going to soon be destroying 133 tons of onions that were illegally smuggled into the country. It all apparently started with a tip-off from a well-meaning member of the public. The authorities then discovered more than 6,000 sacks of the offending onions that had reached the docks of Central Java. How they got there, Kat, still a total mystery. In what I can only assume is a very poor translation at the hands of AI, the agriculture minister was quoted by the Antara news agency as saying, and forgive me if I don't get through this on the first time, "The onions did not pay tax. They were smuggled in and pose risks to our ecosystem by potentially bringing in bacteria and diseases." That last part, at least, is accurate, Kat, much like in Australia. Biosecurity is a major issue here. The authorities are saying they've found indications these onions may be carrying bacteria that's not yet present in Indonesia, and if that spread, it could have pretty disastrous impacts on local farmers. Can't say so much about the tax evasion by the onions, but the biosecurity part is real.
You know what? I'm not trying to mock the importance of biosecurity, but I do think I'm kind of keen to move to Indonesia now because onions are offensive to me, albeit in a completely unrelated way. I'm not offended by their lack of tax paying. But, you know, if I can just break with journalistic impartiality for a moment and admit that I wholeheartedly support the Indonesian government's onion crackdown, if that's what we have to call it, Claudia.
Look, Kat, if that's what it takes to get you over here, then I'll back it. Come to Indonesia.
You're inspiring me. And that, I suppose, is the world this week. If you're enjoying the pod, be sure to like and subscribe. We will have a brand new episode for you every Thursday.
And a big thanks to the producers behind the pod. They are Nick Ludlam, Ali Cheevers, and Billy Dallenberg. Thanks to you for listening. If you've made it this far, well done. And see you next time, Kat.
See you soon, Claudia.